Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have with us David Seeloff. He is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. And as many of you know, he carries on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. Go to the website, www.askelm.com. There's a wealth of information there. Also, you can email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And don't be shy about emailing David Seeloff. He's a really nice fellow. Quit laughing in the background. You're messing up my stuff. Anyway, this is part 3 of 101 Bible Secrets. And we open this tonight with secret number 11. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgia.
are we funny or what?
Yeah, well, we talk before and we talk after, and we cover a lot of material, and someday we'll cover it all on the air.
Oh, wow. That would be a treat for a lot of people, let me tell you.
Well, Bible secret number 11 from the book 101 Bible Secrets. It's both available for purchase, but it's also available free online on the ASK website. And Bible secret number 11 is called, Are Angels Part of the Godhead? And, of course, angels are called spirits in the Bible, but are they part of the divine family that makes up the Godhead? Now, in Hebrews 1:7, it says dogmatically that angels are spirits, but not one of the angels is a son of God, as is Jesus. And this is made plain in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 5, and we've covered this in the Sons of God presentation, but their angels are not like human beings, or they're not like a son of God like Jesus, or the sons of God talked about in Genesis 6.
They're a different species.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. They're not like human beings who are called children of God in 1 John chapter 3 in Greek 1, verse 1, which the word children actually is in the Greek children. It's not sons. It's sons in the King James, but it's actually children of God in the Greek.
And God never addresses an angel as a son, right?
Never.
Okay.
Never. That's correct. Now, Hebrews said that angels, though they are spirits, are not in the same classification of possessing the divine nature as is Christ Jesus and also human beings such as ourselves.
Right.
All references to sons of God in any part of the Bible, Old Testament or New Testament, it refers to either those in the family of God in heaven, around the throne of God, who are advisors and counselors, or those on earth, such as ourselves. And this would, you know, the references are Genesis 6, verse 1 and verse 4, and Job chapter 1 and verse 6, and chapter 2, verse 1. The person sitting at the right hand of God in heaven right now, as recorded in Psalm 110, verse 1, is a son of God, whom David called his Lord. That's Jesus Christ. He was not an angelic being of high authority, not an angelic being, in Psalm 110, verse 1. Only those within the intimate family of God can be called sons and daughters of God, and this includes humans, but not angels.
No matter. Now, how come Scripture does not say daughters?
Well, in 1 John, it talks about sons and daughters.
Okay.
It does, which includes us. We don't know why in the Old Testament there's no reference to daughters of God, whether they're not just mentioned, but they're up there, or whether they're not, there aren't any up there. After all, in Genesis 6, verse 1 and verse 4, the sons of God came down to the daughters of men and found them appealing, and they married those women. And these were not angels that married women. Now, I believe that angels also cohabited with women, but they never married them.
Yeah.
And they produced hybrids of different kinds and shades and, with different results.
Right.
Always bad, by the way.
Well, it destabilized the original genetic pattern that God had given.
It seems to be the case, although that genetic structure was so powerful that it, pushed on through anyway. Especially, remember it said that Noah was perfect in his generations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that didn't have to do with morality because, although he was a righteous man, but that seems to, from the text, seems to also to indicate his birth and his family were perfect. Now, that's just him and his sons. Doesn't necessarily mean that the Noah's wife or their daughters, that or the women that married the sons, were perfect in their generation. But Noah was, and therefore his sons were. So, God kind of started over genetically also after the flood through Noah and his sons. So humans at present are temporarily lower than the angels in authority. And this is during our training period here on earth. And this is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 2, verses 6 to 9. Humans, when we are redeemed in the future, in our resurrection, we will become actual and real members of the family of God, which will then judge even the angels. And this includes the highest of the angelic powers. And this is in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 2 and 3. Now, even now, in our human flesh, we are reckoned as part of the divine family because of our attachment to Christ. And as I mentioned, this is in 1 John chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. But angels are not, nor ever will be, a part of that singular divine family, or Elohim, that angels are created beings to serve God and to serve us who are God's children and a part of the family. Now, what's the role of angels? How do they fit in this system then? Angels are the servants. Remember the old show on PBS called Upstairs, Downstairs? It told about the rich family that and their goings-on and what happened to them and their family members, and they lived upstairs. And downstairs were the servants. They were part of the household, but they were not part of the family.
Yeah, okay.
And when the servant went to buy things or to send a message to somebody, it was as if the master of the house sent him and that servant could speak for the master of the house. Just like when, who was it that Abraham sent? Eleazar.
Yes.
Abraham sent Eleazar to speak with Laban to find Isaac a wife. And they found his Laban's sister. And Eleazar had full authority in Genesis to speak for Abraham and to make the deal for the marriage. Abraham did not go. He sent his servant to find a wife for Isaac. And he did, and he came back, and it's actually one of the most beautiful stories in the scripture of an ideal, perfect marriage.
Well, it was like Abraham gave Eleazar a power of attorney.
Exactly.
That's
what the powerful angelic beings, like the angel of the Lord and Gabriel and Michael, they also have that power of attorney to stand up for Israel at proper times, and to grab Satan and throw him into the bottomless pit, into the lake of fire, at the end of Revelation. And, they have great, great power, but they're part of the household, but they're not part of the family.
Okay.
And each of us has, each believer has a guardian angel that watches over us, and in some cases protects us, in some cases they louse up and they will be judged for their mistakes. All foreseen by God, but, you know, God works through delegated authority and through agents and angels and all sorts of things, but they're not part of the family. They don't live upstairs.
Yeah.
And yet they caretake for us. They're caretakers of us. And, you know, they watch over us and take care of us, probably more than we ever dream. And it's probably gotten us out of more scrapes than we realize. We'll find out someday. Now, they're in the background, and we're not supposed to relate to them or commune with them or try to communicate with them. That's not good for them. It's not good for us. So just, you know, don't even go there. Wasting your time.
Can we ask Father to make our angels behave?
I've never thought of that, of course.
You know.
Why not?
Okay. But we don't ask...
if they're not doing their job.
Yeah, but we don't communicate directly with the angels.
No.
Right.
No. Because then that becomes a mediator. And Paul said that there's, in 1 Corinthians 8:6, there's one mediator between God, and that's the Father, and that mediator is Jesus Christ.
Right.
There's one mediator and one Lord Jesus Christ. And... He's the only mediator there is. There's no angelic mediators
anymore.
There was. It was angels that gave the law from God to Israel. And this is quite clear and spoken of in Hebrews, that it was given by angelic mediators. But now, once Christ was incarnated, lived, and crucified and resurrected on our behalf, now there are no more mediators. Neither is the law, which was for school children, necessary anymore. You know, we've grown out of that, or we certainly should have.
Yeah.
Those people that continue to keep those laws that are for children are, you know, they're sitting in the small seats in kindergarten, trying to fit their huge bodies and their huge rear ends in these little tiny seats, and they wonder why they're uncomfortable trying to observe this law, which was made for school children.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're continually doing ABCs.
Yeah.
And, you know, spirituality goes way beyond that.
Oh, far, far, far beyond. Yes, you're right.
So angels are part of the household, and they can be called Elohim because they are delegated on occasion that status to speak for the Father and for Christ. The angels in the book of Revelation were delegated. And remember when John, because of the marvelous nature of this angel that spoke to him, he fell down in worship? Now, that just meant that he went on both knees and bowed the head to this being because he was such in awe of the marvelous glory of this being. And the angel was horrified and said, don't do that. Get up, please. I'm not worthy of worship, but, you know, the Lamb is. So, you know, they have their place. They should keep their place. The cherub in Ezekiel 28 did not keep his place, and he will be judged for that severely. The cherub, the angelic being in Ezekiel 28.
And mature, if there is such a thing as a mature Christian, should not compromise an angel by communing with him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, because that is something that we would be judged for.
Yeah, and it's useless. You know, it's like a friend of mine said, it's like trying to teach a pig to sing.
Yeah.
You'll never do it, and it'll irritate the pig.
Yeah.
So, you know, it serves no purpose. Likewise, trying to communicate with them, and there's whole organizations that try to do this. All of so-called white magic tries to do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's an exercise in futility. And, you know, if Satan can pawn himself off as an angel of righteousness, certainly all the others can and do also.
Sure.
They all can play that game. It's a dangerous, dangerous game.
That's
and
it's
stupid. It's not for us.
Right.
I mean, what did John say in the end of his epistle of 1 John? He says, little children, flee from idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you don't look back. You don't play Lot's wife and look back. You get the heck out of there. You turn your back to it, and you go as fast as you can.
Right.
It's not a joke. It's dangerous stuff. You don't play with it. If you're attacked, that's different.
Well, you know,
you face it.
Communing with angels, you're opening the door to demonic things.
And you're tempting them.
Yeah.
It's not fair to them.
That's right.
If they need to communicate with you, need to, as in the case of Peter, being let out of jail. But remember, they didn't hang around and sit around and talk about this, what they did for Peter.
Right.
They did their job, they got there, and suddenly they were gone.
Right.
Same with every angelic encounter throughout the Bible. They perform what they're supposed to perform, and then they leave.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean they're not still there, they're just invisible.
Yeah.
And they're out of there. And the minute they fulfill their purpose, their immediate purpose, they're gone, or at least not visible.
Another question. When people do things that they should not be doing, does their angel bear witness to the wrongs that they do?
What do you mean, bear witness?
They know that the person has done wrong. And I'm wondering if in judgment, when judgment comes, an angel can say, oh, yes, this person did this.
Well, they might be limited as to, you know, someday we'll know and see what influence they had, and, you know, how they, if indeed they can influence our thoughts, I don't know. To what extent they can guide us or have guided us. I think in general, the more hands off, the better.
Yeah.
From their point of view. And I don't even, you know, Dr. Martin has some excellent articles on the website about angels, and you just type in angels and go through the material in the search engine. You know, and that'll lead you to the major biblical passages on that material. But, you know, it's an interesting subject, and it relates directly to, you know, who we are as
yes.
beings. And a lot of the principalities and powers that the Apostle Paul talks about in Colossians and other Ephesians, and even in Philippians to a certain extent, a lot of those beings are out there, and part of our, you know, responsibility in the resurrection for the ecclesia, not for Israel, but Israel will reconcile the nations on earth, and our purpose, the ecclesia, will be to be among the celestials and reconcile the beings out there, the ones that aren't here.
That's awesome.
So, you know, we'll be busy, and we'll have a lot of contact with them.
Now, in the book of Revelation, where it says the beast, the Antichrist, this person, false prophet, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
Makes the stars fall from the sky. Is this, can we understand this, David, as being a people on the planet that have weaponry that literally shoot down craft that are piloted by angels?
That's in actually Daniel 8, verse 10, where it talks about the little horn which comes out at the end.
Uh-huh.
And it said in verse 10, it, meaning the horn, waxed great, even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground. and stamped upon them. I don't fully understand, of course, what is referred to, but we're not talking about the star Antares, which is several times, you know, 50 times larger than our sun, where that's cast to Earth and stomped on. It's talking about the heavenly host.
Yeah, stars are
angels.
Yeah, stars are equated with angels, aren't they?
Now, what it means by trampling them, I have no idea.
Wow.
The translation of the Septuagint reads the same way as the English translations from the Hebrew. Mm. So there's not quite distinction. You know, there's not a translation problem here in this verse. But who knows, you know, exactly what's being talked about? We might find out sooner than later, within decades, exactly. You know, some of us will live through this. Yeah. There is a definite relationship between stars and angels.
Right.
Satan's called the morning star, and well, so is Christ. That doesn't mean that Christ is an angel, but that's a label and a term that is applied to both of them, star of the morning. And the, you know, the stars shouted for joy. The sons of God shouted for joy, and the stars rejoiced when the creation came.
That's in Job.
Yeah. So there's something going on here regarding stars and angels. It's not exactly clear. I think we'll know as we study more and learn more and more exactly what's going on. But whether he'll use technology to do that, or whether the power that the little horn will have, the Antichrist will have from Satan, will allow him to cast down the stars and stomp on them, trample them, it says, I have no idea. This would probably take place after Satan is cast down from heaven, after the war in heaven in Revelation chapter 12. After that.
Oh, my goodness.
So that some will follow, and some, you know, whether he's, I would assume that the Antichrist is taking down some of the good guys. Mm. I mean, why would he be fighting them otherwise?
Right, right.
Perhaps some of the protecting angels that are protecting Israel.
Yeah.
Because it's not, remember, in Revelation chapter 12, it talks about Satan and his messengers,
right,
and Michael and his messengers.
Yes.
We always assume that all angels, all messengers, spiritual messengers, are God's angels. Well, that's not necessarily the case.
Now, are we talking, when you say protecting Israel, are we talking about the political Israel of today, or are we talking about Jerusalem?
It would primarily be the people in Israel at that time,
The
Jews and Israelites, which now are pretty much merged, in my understanding. They're distinguished by God, but certainly not by you and me.
Yeah.
Those people who live in that territory at that time.
Okay.
That's what I would say. Whether there'll be a political state at that time of Israel as we know it today with the current boundaries, I don't know. I tend to think so, but the question has been raised in my mind recently that I don't read that necessarily in the scripture.
Mm-hmm.
That we superimpose current conditions on biblical statements.
You're right.
And we needn't necessarily do that. We have a certain concept of what a nation should be, with strict boundaries and a governmental structure in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
That might change back to an earlier biblical model than what we have today.
Right.
The 10 nations plus Israel might form a unified state, and that Israel would be a state within a state, like a common market type of situation. And then they'll turn on Israel. But that means that there's going to be a period of stability where not only are current of animosities be worked out, but then there'll be a period of prosperity,
right,
and joy and happiness before the final destruction. Because remember, it says, let me bring that up, that Israel will be attacked at a period when they have unwalled cities. This is in Ezekiel 38:11, where it says, I will go up to the land of unwalled, this is Gog, at the time of Gog and Magog, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages, and I will go to them that are at rest and that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. Now that means not just within the cities of Israel as we see them today, but it also means between the states that neighbor Israel, so that we're, Israel will be at peace with their neighbors. And that's certainly not the case now, but that's when Gog, the Antichrist, attacks in Ezekiel 38.
Mm-hmm.
So things are going to change,
yes,
quite a bit.
Yes.
And, I've made a flip statement in the past of back to angels, but I think we're going to see these supernatural beings walking down the street.
I agree.
And, well, we've talked about this before, because their time is going to be so short, and, the evil ones particularly, that they're going to have to make their power and their, their influence known, and, this will change people's reality, paradigm shift for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
Most people, and if the marvelous revelations that we see coming, whether it's through David's tomb or whatever, but the restitution of all things, when this stuff starts happening, the bad side is going to have to respond, and they're going to respond by being overt and blatant.
Yes.
And, they're going to have to come out of the woodwork, as they did before the time of Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, all these temples, when they performed these rituals, the gods responded.
Yeah.
These people weren't stupid. They didn't just do these things because it was fun. A lot of work to run a sacrificial system, and the pagans had hundreds of them in the various countries around the world.
Right.
It was big business, and they don't do this unless you get something. And what they got was supernatural response from the local god, whoever it was, whether it was an angelic or a son of God or whatever. Now, at the time of Christ, there was two major changes in history. One was at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, and another was at the time of Christ. At the time of the Nebuchadnezzar, the older gods went away. These would be the sons of God. During the time of Christ, something shifted so that Satan lost some influence and power.
Mm-hmm.
And Plutarch, the author of Plutarch's Lives, a Roman author who lived in the first century and the early part of the second century, wrote an entire book, and it's on the internet, called On the Cessation of Oracles. It's an interesting little book because he's a pagan author, didn't know anything about Christianity, but he was a priest at Delphi. And he said, suddenly the oracle at Delphi and the other major oracles around the world stopped working.
Yeah.
Suddenly they'd ask questions, they'd go through the rituals, they'd do the drugs, the prophetess or the prophets would go into their trance, but they wouldn't get any result anymore. like the system had broken down. And whereas before it was, if you do A, B, and C, you get result D. It's like a scientific formula. If you do this, this, and this, you get this result, and it's repeatable. Well, it's not quite repeatable if the God is in a good mood or whatever. But it repeated enough and was reproducible enough that it was dependable.
Yeah.
That's why they did auguries and entrails and all this stuff, because they got useful results.
Oh, gee.
You know, they got lying results, but this is all spirit-driven. Spirits were involved, evil spirits in almost in every case. You know, and so, but suddenly in the first century, all this stuff stopped working. Well, the only thing that really occurred was the, you know, crucifixion and resurrection of Christ.
Right.
And Paul talks about Christ taking authority over the principalities and powers. So something changed, but, you know, the demons were still around. They're still around today.
Yes.
And, but something shifted and changed, both in the time of Nebuchadnezzar and in the time of Christ, so that, you know, things were different, and I haven't quite worked out in my own mind how that works out in everyday society, pagan society, but, you know, this had to do with the, particularly after the revelation of the mystery to Paul and John and others in 63 A.D., you know, things where the final revelation of God came out, that we would become part of the God family, that needs to be investigated in relationship to the cessation of oracles, whether it was a sudden thing or whether it was a gradual thing over a period of years or decades. You know, this needs to be studied, and, you know, this is something that all the scholars of the world pretty much ignore, even the Christian scholars. The cessation of oracles was a big deal, but nobody looks at it because it doesn't fit into their worldview that, you know, the supernatural world doesn't really exist. Well, it does, and it exists, and it's real, and it has a reality to it. But these entities, evil spirits, are not necessarily angels. Not all evil spirits are angels, and not all just like all angels are not evil. It's a sliding scale, and probably a lot of are gray, a lot of gray area, both with the spirits. But the bottom line is we shouldn't communicate with any of them,
right,
under any circumstances. And this is the great danger of certain classification of drugs, especially the hallucinogens. They were originally used, whether it's drugs or mushrooms or certain types of hallucinogenic herbs, to prepare the body and to allow the body for spirits to come in so that the body could commune or be even possessed by these spirits. And very dangerous stuff.
Well, alcohol does that too.
Right, right, to a certain extent. Although Scripture talks about alcohol as being a beneficial thing.
Well, yeah, in moderation, yes.
Right, right.
Yes.
And, or even to get happy sometimes. You know, it makes the heart merry. There's nothing wrong with that. But you're right, alcohol can be used for that and for that purposes. So was tobacco, in its strongest form. That's what the American Indians used it for. They used it to relax the body, to be able to commune. Now, does that mean tobacco is wrong per se? Well, certainly in the adulterated way it's now, it's just a poison.
Yeah.
There's no beneficial use, and probably wasn't back then anyway. But, you know, the use by Europeans during the, you know, once tobacco was brought over there, it really didn't hurt them very much, as far as we can tell. It was just a social thing. But anyway, we're getting off of angels. But the purpose of a lot of this stuff was to commune with these spirits, and we're not supposed to do that. They're literally servants that we don't have authority over now unless we are attacked or offended. Then we can pull rank, so to speak, on them.
Well, like, but, you know, some people will say they pray that angels will surround their home or their whatever. They should not do that. They should ask God to do that.
Right, and he'll do it however he chooses to do it.
Right.
He'll delegate whatever and whatever's necessary.
Right.
You know, the more mature we become as Christians, the less we should need their help. But that, like you say, we leave it up to God.
Mm-hmm.
He knows what's best for us.
Right.
You know, so the angels are useful and God delegates them to do things for us and to help us when he so chooses. And they screw up and we'll judge them. So that's a very winded version of, you know, number 11.
Okay.
Number 12, secret, Bible secret number 12 is, does God commit evil? And, you know, does God ever commit evil or create bad things in the world and the universe? Well, the quick answer is absolutely. It's common in today's theological world, however, to be told that God and Christ can only perform, quote, good, end quote, in the universe. And we're told that it's always Satan or his evil angels who are the perpetrators of bad or evil and not God. The truth, however, is very different from this erroneous teaching. While God and Christ can never sin, because sin is the transgression of the law, and this we get in 1 John 3, verse 4, it's God and Christ who set all the rules and the laws in the universe, and they can change them to suit their own purposes anytime they wish.
That's right.
And yet we do find that God does perform evil quite consistently in his acts as ruler over the universe. It even states good and evil.
Why does he allow wars? I mean, is the...
Yeah,
that's
well,
an awful thing.
We've covered that before. It's bottom line is to teach us what it's like to live without God for a period of time. And, you know, actually the blessed ones are probably those that are, you know, die off when they're young. You know, but they'll have their own difficulties when they grow, even in the resurrection. But in Isaiah 45:7, very interesting, it says, I, talking about God, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Now, the word evil in 45:7 of Isaiah is the common word for evil as opposed to good and as opposed to peace in this verse. Light and darkness, peace and evil. And God does these things. In 1 Samuel chapter 2, verses 6 and 7, it says, quote, the Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and brings up. In other words, he will resurrect and can resurrect. The Lord makes poor. The Lord makes rich. He brings low and he lifts up. He raises up the poor out of the dust and lifts up the beggar from the dunghill to set them among princes and to make them inherit the throne of glory. It's amazing, but, you know, riches and wealth and being raised to a high station, these are, God does this many times, two people and four people.
Right.
Doesn't mean that those people aren't smart, but a lot of smart people are poor.
Oh, you
a lot
bet.
Of smart people are downtrodden.
Yes.
And in Deuteronomy 32, verse 39, it says, quote, see now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God with me. I kill and I make alive, I wound and I heal, and neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand. In Isaiah 54, verse 16, it says, I have created the waster to destroy. Sometimes this is Satan. You think of the death angel in Satan in regard to Job. The death angel just at the Passover, killing the firstborn children. Most of them were innocent. They had nothing to do with what was going on. Most of the firstborn were quite young. In Proverbs chapter 16, verse 4, it says, "The Lord has made all things for himself. Yes, even the wicked for the day of evil." In other words, many times, wicked people have a purpose that God uses them for, like Nebuchadnezzar and Pharaoh and Balaam and Balak and even King Saul, the Amalekites and Haman in the book of Esther. These were all people used for purpose to show God's power. And in Lamentations verse 3 and verse 38, chapter 3 and verse 38, it says, "Out of the mouth of the Most High proceed not evil and good?" is the question. In Daniel 4, verse 35, "All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say unto God, unto God, what do you, or why do you do these things, or who are you to do them?" James chapter 4, verse 12, "There is one lawgiver which is able to save and to destroy." And what about all the evil and the wickedness that we see in the world today? Acts chapter 15, verse 18, it says, "Known unto God are all his works from the beginning of the world." So that much of what goes on is actually allowed and planned and required by God to happen. The good and the evil and the wars. Remember, we mentioned that most of the time, God uses wars to change boundaries and to change rulers. And as we've covered in previous presentations, God chooses the boundaries and the leaders of a nation and the events that happen in there. Well, he uses wars to do that kind of stuff. And why does he do that? In the way that he does it, why can't he do it peacefully? Well, he has a purpose that he's working out here below, and that's the best answer I can give now. But what you should do is take a concordance and check, and you can do this on the Bibles that are online on the internet, and check all the words in the Bible, all the verses in the Bible in which the word evil is used, and you'll be amazed that most often it is God who uses evil to accomplish his purposes on earth. And after all, the fact of God being God means that he has complete control over everything on earth and in the universe. And this necessarily means that God controls and uses evil quite consistently.
He also would then control the entity that we call Satan.
Yeah, just as he did in Job. He delegates authority to him and also puts boundaries on what he does and cannot do.
Yeah.
Just as he did with the death angel. That death angel at the Passover, the very first Passover, could only kill the firstborn. He couldn't kill anyone else, only the firstborn. Mm. So he had definite limits on him.
Yeah.
And, if the blood wasn't on the door and if they weren't doing what they were supposed to do, that death angel came in even among the Israelites. It didn't matter whether you were an Israelite or not. It's just the Israelites were warned what to do, and the Egyptians were not.
Yeah.
So preachers and priests are wrong when they say that God can only create and perform good, and that in fact, God is as active in performing evil as he does perform good. What makes God to be God is the fact that he can do what he pleases, and he does do that.
Does he micromanage?
I hesitate to put our definitions of things, but
okay.
I know and understand your question, and I don't have a good answer for that. he does when he wants to and doesn't, you know, delegates. He probably micromanages in terms of the result, but we wouldn't recognize it as such from any point of view, not ours or the angels.
Okay.
That's my take on it, and I could be 100% wrong. You know, it we read the verses that says he accomplishes everything he wants done. Once again, we come back to, you know, free will and causation and who does what.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bottom line is, on any particular instance, we can't tell, except regarding when you started to accept the truth, when I started to accept the truth, that was a definite act of an intervention from God.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that, because that's more important than many other things. And that's even recognized by the angels, and that they actually rejoice when one sinner repents.
But you know, David, it makes a lot of us feel like we're just pawns. You know, we're told we have free will, but at the same time, I think it's more on the lines of free will to fulfill God's plan.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and he could, you know, in many cases, he can accomplish what he wants through our free will.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way to look at it, in terms of, you know, we're definitely limited by circumstance. We can't fly, and we can't, you know, run faster than a certain speed, given our size and weight or age. And you can multiply in the thousands those limitations on each one of us. And, you know, let's take a singular event like a traffic accident.
Mm-hmm.
How we respond immediately before, during, and after that accident can be predicted by him, but we're limited by our physical abilities in the circumstances in which we find ourselves. You know, if we're a passenger, we don't have control of the car.
Right.
If we're driving, we might or might not be able to avoid the accident.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, I've had an incident when I was a new Christian in which I've had the wheel of a car wrenched to the side to avoid an accident.
Out of your hand.
My hands were on the wheel, but the wheel turned.
Wow. Yes. Yes.
Away from a head-on collision, and I had three other baby Christians in there with me.
Wow.
And I was just in awe. And it was a stupid mistake on my part, but I started to turn left, and that wheel was wrenched to the right. And I don't know what made me turn left or want to turn left, but it would have been a head-on.
Oh, my gosh.
Into the, you know, it was just a stupid thing, and that wheel was wrenched to the and I didn't react that I know of, because I was preoccupied. I remember my thoughts at that moment. I was preoccupied with something else. That's why I started to turn. Somebody was talking about some discussion that made me want to turn left. Now, maybe that was an evil influence that made me turn left, but something else made me turn right. And, you know, those things haven't happened in a long time because, you know, I don't do stupid, silly things like that anymore.
Right.
Or if I do, I'm on my own. I don't know. You know, and I bet if any baby Christian or any mature Christian looking back, they probably had help in certain places. I think you've admitted that in the past.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things go on all the time. Now, was that an angelic thing, or what happened there? I don't I couldn't tell you. I didn't feel any hands or anything move the wheel. The wheel just turned, the steering wheel. And hence the front wheels turned, and, you know, we didn't crash into them. Everybody looked at me like I was crazy. But, you know, I just chalked it up. You know, and I didn't spend days or years. You know, some people make well, why did that happen? What does it mean? Well, it means that I didn't die and I didn't kill other people in the process.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Let it go. You know, don't dwell on it. And yet I have other friends who will spend years in awe of that and try and, you know, search the scriptures to see what, you know, it's not a big deal. Like I said, we'll probably be surprised to the extent we've been helped and protected over time.
True.
And, you know, who knows? So that's angels and evil and that sort of thing. So, let's see. Back to evil. You know, as for humans, we are not given the privileges that God takes to himself. In other words, we should not try to use evil to bring good. And, you know, we're very prone to do that often. Only God can bring good out of evil.
Right.
And we, you know, when nations go to war, they try to bring good out of evil. World War II did that to a certain extent, but it was by the grace of God that we won.
Yeah.
Because the Germans, you know, flipping a few switches in the minds of some key German scientists, they could have developed the bomb first. But they took a wrong research path.
Well, we brought them over here, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And none of us humans are capable of bringing good out of evil.
That's true.
Using evil for good. And every indication in the Bible in regard to evil is for us to shun it and to avoid its use. And as Romans 12:17 says, recompense to no man evil for evil. And boy, we sure want to do that. Almost all of literature and movies are that.
Yeah.
You know, look, the greatest evil that ever occurred to a man was the crucifixion of Christ. But God turned that around for evil, for good. And not only good, but righteousness and blessedness for the whole human race. And only God can do that kind of thing. He's done it in your life and in my life, and he'll do it for everyone's life eventually in God's own purpose. So this was, you know, Bible secret number 12 in Dr. Martin's little book, you know, the 101 Bible secrets. So let's quickly go to 13, and this is a short one. And this is, does God ever lie? Would God ever cause people to believe a falsehood or to believe a lie? Well, the quick answer is yes. We are told explicitly that there are two things in which it is impossible for God to lie. And that is in regard to his promises and oaths to mankind and to angels.
Right.
This is specifically stated in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 18. But God has caused people to believe falsehoods in the past. In 1 Kings chapter 22 and verse 23, it says specifically, it's a fascinating story to read at the end of 1 Kings. It says, quote, "The Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets." These are evil prophets, but God specifically told them a lie for those evil prophets to tell. And it resulted in the death of a king. If people wish to continue in wickedness and deceivableness, God will respond and retort in kind. And this is in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 10. And we're actually told that God will cause delusion in the future to come upon the wicked people of the world. It says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 11, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie. So does God actually lie to people? Well, God causes people to believe falsehoods and to believe lies. And in other words, he set up for them to believe a lie. Did God set up Adam and Eve to believe the lie of Satan, that they wouldn't die if they ate of the apple? Seems so, doesn't it?
It sure does.
When you view that scenario in this, in the light of, you know, God allowing people to, certainly he exposed them to the lie.
And he was very furious afterwards,
right? Yeah. He exposes them to contrary, you know, statements. They acted wrong, and then God punished them for it. Well, they're supposed to believe God, but how much instruction beyond that did they actually have?
Right.
I don't know. So that's, you know, chapter 13, or secret number 13. Let's take a look at 14. Yeah, let's hold off on 14. You know, let's do that next time.
Okay.
Take a break now.
Okay. Ah, very interesting, David. And
well, we covered a little more than the book did, but
yeah. But you know, this business of the angels and spirits and things. Is there any indication before we close this particular segment that there are sons of God on the earth today?
That's an interesting question, because Psalm 82 talks about the sons of God being given a death sentence. And it's not talking about us, human beings. It's talking about these spiritual beings who are called sons of God.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that sons of God can die because Christ, who was the Son of God, the only begotten Son of God,
right,
he did die.
Well, there were many sons of God, but only
right,
one begotten, and that was Jesus Christ. Correct.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Hold on. Dropped my phone and
crashed.
Lost my thing here.
Oh.
Oh. Interesting. sorry about that.
That's okay.
Okay. My headset came unplugged from my phone, and okay, are there sons of God on earth now? Remember, it says that Christ talks about, as in the days of Noah, they will be marrying and giving in marriage. Well, that's a reference to the time period before the flood.
Right.
And it's talking about the time, and the section about the flood opens up in Genesis 6, talking about the sons of God coming down and marrying these human women.
Mm-hmm.
These sons of God are not human beings. They can't be, because these sons of God produced Nephilim, which, as we know from Goliath and Gog and the sons of Anakim, these turned out to be giants. Well, humans marrying humans don't create giants consistently. But the sons of God did produce giants, monsters, you might say, monstrous humans, that were in the land when Israel came into, from the Exodus, came into the land.
Yeah.
And they had to be killed off or driven off. These were the result of the marrying and matings of the sons of God with the daughters of men. So these are supernatural beings creating hybrids with the daughters of men, with women. This is what began the evil of the pre-flood world after in the time of Noah.
Right.
So that things got so bad, this is what Christ was talking about, at least partially, not just about the evil of the world before the flood, but his reference to marrying and giving in marriage to me specifically relates to the sons of God. If that happened in the time of Noah, and also after the flood, and if that's going to happen during the time before Christ returns, then yes, there are sons of God around the earth, if not in the earth, or mm-hmm. on the earth right
okay.
now.
Okay.
I would say yes. Mm. However, whether this relates to the UFO activity, I would tend to think yes.
Yeah, I kind of do too.
How this all filters out, I don't know. But there's, you know, sometimes these things are physical and sometimes they're not. And there's substantial evidence both ways. And it seems to be, are they physical or are they spiritual? And the answer is yes.
Yeah, okay.
They're both.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, if you consider the Antichrist and the peoples at the end fighting against Christ as they gather at Armageddon, you've got angels, you have cherubs, you have perhaps even evil archangels, you have Satan, you have sons of God all on the side of the Antichrist, and this is why they think they might be able to win.
Wow.
At least they think they might be able to destroy the earth enough to prevent the earth from being having anything left to be ruled by Christ.
Or to have it in a condition where it cannot be inhabited by human beings.
Right.
Yeah.
And remember it says, if these days were not shortened, there would be no life left on earth.
No flesh left alive.
No flesh left alive.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
So, this stuff is going to be going on. You've got an army of 200 million coming out of the Euphrates that are spirit beings that will somehow be put down and killed off, probably by the Antichrist in an incredibly vicious war of some kind that's spoken about.
Yeah.
In Book of Revelation. And these are not human beings. These are not the Indians and the Chinese coming out of the Euphrates and riding 200 million horses.
No,
hardly. No. And so you've got 400 spirit beings, 400 million, 200 riders and 200 things being ridden, 200 million, 400 million spirit beings coming out of the Euphrates. Whether that's part of the pit, I don't know, but they're loosed and released. You know, that's a lot of allies, or it seems to be a lot of allies.
Yeah.
To whether they'll be fighting against Christ or trying to kill humans, it seems that they're killing humans. And this has to happen before the time of the end, and that'll take, you know, it's not going to happen overnight. It'll take years. They'll be in the physical because they're going to be killing human beings. It's going to be a very busy time.
Oh, yes. Well, with the sons of God, if you saw one, would you recognize it as such?
I don't know. Depends how they manifest themselves. I mean,
can they shapeshift, David? Are they given that capability?
I would say that they would be able to carry their reality with them. For example, you know, Abraham recognized the angels, and yet it uses the term men.
Yeah.
Not in terms of, you know, that they appeared to be men.
Mm-hmm.
Not in terms that they were humans. It doesn't use the word Adam. It used the word Ish,
okay.
Which means male.
Okay.
And, so they appeared to be as normal men, but yet he knew that they were special, that they were different. So I would say, yes, we'd probably be able to distinguish if we encountered them.
Wow.
But being evil, we have authority over even them.
Oh, my goodness. I thought our authority was only over the angels, not over...
Well, if they overstep their authority, and there's a death sentence upon them, those sons of God, In other words, I think it's open season on them. If you read Psalm 82, God says, you shall die like men. Well, I don't think all of them died. I think the judgment that God placed on them, which is a formal sentencing in Psalm 82, it's a formal, in Hebrew, there's a formal structure mm-hmm. of a law court and then a sentencing. And Psalm 82 is the judgment part of that formal court structure in which God pronounces the death sentence on the sons of God. And you shall all die like men. Well, men didn't have to be told that they are going to die like men.
Right.
Especially in a society where blood and death was a part of everyday life.
Not much has changed.
Well, they killed their own, you know, they killed their own animals for food.
Yeah.
We don't do that. We're farther, you know, everything is sanitized.
Mm-hmm.
When we, in the Western world, when we die, when somebody dies, they're put in a casket and buried.
Yeah.
Well, in the Middle East, sometimes they're put in a casket, sometimes they're just carried to the grave. If they're poor.
Yeah.
So, you know, they just dig a hole and put them in. So death is very much closer, and certainly was in those days, than it is today. We try to sanitize things.
Yeah, we sure do.
And it, you know, those entities can be killed now. Whether they're limited to the physical, I have no idea. You know, I just don't know. They're different from Satan. Whether they're under Satan's control, I don't know. But the oracles don't work, and the you know, the ancient temples have all crumbled and gone away. So you know, whether they are in contact with people, whether they're going to be marrying women, whether this is what the elite are doing these days for fun and power.
Yeah.
Who knows? As many people feel that this is what's going on. All through history, people have entertained angels unawares,
right.
Good and bad,
right.
As well as there was a tradition in pagan religions where the king would commune with the god or be possessed with a god and would have sexual relations with the goddess or with the priestess in the temples. And that sometimes the god would possess the king and would produce, you know, an offspring. And this was, you know, what Alexander the Great, the four stories from the ancient authors, which were written several hundred years after Alexander lived, but from records, talk about that Alexander was seen to be a god, or a part half-god.
Well, there's a story about his mother.
Right.
You know, yeah.
And that's portrayed in the movie, Alexander the Great.
Right.
Taken from some of the written works that were written hundreds of years after Alexander died.
Yeah.
But, you know, this stuff was common in pagan writings. You read the writings by the Assyrian annals of the kings of Assyria, and it talks about how, you know, such and such a king, Sargon, when he was young, he spent hours talking to the goddess. And this wasn't even in the temple. The goddess would come to him in his bedchamber when he was sleeping.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wasn't born of a god. He didn't claim that, but this close communion with gods and goddesses and entities has been going on all through history.
Sure.
Especially with the leaders. And this is why some of these leaders think they're special, chosen by God or the gods, you know, to rule over the masses.
Yeah.
And this is what gives them their drive and their energy. Because they think they were chosen to achieve this, and this is common. Someday we'll get into this material. It's fascinating stuff to read.
Oh, yes.
You wonder, where does this come from? Are they just imagining this? No, these are things that happen to these people, to these kings. And
they become, I think, David, literally possessed.
At one time or another. And
we have leaders on the earth today and have had in recent history that are possessed.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, you watch the speeches of Hitler.
Oh, yeah.
Where he would go into almost a trance-like state, and you can almost pinpoint when that possession state would take effect.
Right.
When he was on the podium, and his voice would change, his mannerisms would change, his eyes would change.
Oh, yes.
His gestures would change. And people noticed this. And on the History Channel, there was one fella talking about the time of the Hitler Youth. And he said he was Jewish. And he knew Hitler was talking against the Jews, but it was so compelling. As this young man of 10 or 12 in the audience, he said it was just wonderful. You just wanted to follow this man anywhere. And, it was just amazing.
Yeah.
And now, that's not normal.
No, it is not.
And yet there's cooperation with the person as well as the entity, a symbiosis, you might say.
Yeah.
And he was just exhausted after these intense things, and he'd have to just literally crash for hours before he could eat something or recover. Sometimes they even had there's reports that they had to carry him off the podium when he was done because he couldn't function anymore. That spirit would leave him, that spirit entity would leave him, and he would just be exhausted. And these reports occur too often in history to be ignored and to think that there were, Constantine, the emperor,
mm-hmm.
who conducted the Nicene Council. Eusebius says that he had thousands of visions from God, in quotes, during his lifetime, mm-hmm. who was telling him all sorts of things of how he should do this and do that. Well, how does that differ from Nathan or Samuel speaking to David and advising them? Or David speaking to God himself, as we covered in 2 Samuel 7. You know, David went to the tabernacle of David and, you know, talked to God. And then God responded through the prophet.
Yeah.
It's not different that much, except that, Yahweh is the true God, and the others are false gods.
Well, it gets down to discernment, and that's a real hard thing for human beings.
Right.
A lot of people say, well, you know, God told me this or God told me that.
And it strokes their ego, and they're just fascinated that they're special. God has chosen to look upon them to help people.
Yeah.
And my wife and I laugh because I know, you know, I've become friends with more than three people like that in my lifetime that haven't done, you might say, a damn thing with their lives because they've had experiences where they've been indicated that they're special.
Mm.
And they're just waiting to be placed on a pedestal to achieve what they've been told they will achieve.
Oh,
and they haven't done anything in the meantime.
Oh, my gosh.
But those people who do something with what they've been told, like a Hitler, and mostly negative, I would even include Joseph Smith or Muhammad, where the spirit was not necessarily from God. It may be allowed by God to contact them, but in reality, that spirit was not from God himself. It was from some other spirit trying to lead people away from the truth of God, which is in the scriptures only. And, contact with spirit entities will only be limited, as far as we can tell, to assistance in emergency situations. Now, you know, young men will dream dreams and the old ones will see visions, or vice versa. It talks about that in Joel, but it's talking about in Israel at a particular time during the tribulation.
And that's when God pours out his spirit?
Right.
Yeah, and it says not only on the men, but on his handmaids also.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. That's not about the whole world.
Right.
That's a focused point.
And it's not necessary for us. It's probably at a time when Scripture will no longer be available because, you know, the deception will come in and the Antichrist will be running around and trying to, and you know, destroy true Christians and believing Israelites, as, you know, killing 2/3 of those who live in Israel.
Yeah.
And, you know, God will help them at that time. So they will need dreams and visions in order to escape.
Right.
The tribulation, which will not be from God. God will do the last punishments on the rest of the world. But he will purify Israel first by allowing the tribulation to occur from the 10 nations and from Edom and the Antichrist. So there's a lot that has to go on.
Oh, yes.
And in the meantime, flee from idolatry.
Yes.
Whether that's little pictures of Jesus or other saints or, you know, whatever it is.
Pictures of movie stars.
Yeah.
No fooling. Yeah.
We idolize them, but primarily with religious idolatry is what it's talking about, of any kind.
Right.
Well, even if it's, you know, Jesus, that's wrong. You're not supposed to make any images or have any images around. It means any, not just a few or for historical purposes. Just get rid of them. You don't need them. What do you need it for? You're in the image of God. I mean,
that's right.
That's what God looks like to a certain extent, two arms, two legs, a head, hopefully.
Yeah.
That you still have your head. So, you know, we covered the short ones, but we didn't get much done.
Well, it's very, very informative, and you answered a lot of the questions that kind of stick out there about these angels and sons of God. And I know that you're going to be reworking the sons of God presentation that we did, and I'm really looking forward to that. And I know other people will be too when they hear this. Okay, David. God bless you for doing all this, my goodness. And we will be back with part 4 of 101 Bible Secrets. We have just finished part 3. And you can get a hold of David Seeloff through the website askelm.com. Email David Seeloff, and don't you laugh now, David, at this address, david@askelm.com. He is a very nice man to communicate with, and I am sure that if you have a question about something that David has said, email him and ask him. He does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest Del Martin. And that work was certainly, certainly blessed by God himself, because he sure did leave the world a great deal of very good information.
Right, an unbelievable legacy, and to the extent that we are ever able to see further, it's because we're standing on his shoulders.
That's right.
And others, but you know, he helps open up Scripture so much.
Yes, he did. And people out there that have stood on his shoulders in academia and understand about God and what goes around comes around should give Dr. Ernest L. Martin his due credit.
Yeah.
I'm very upset that there are so many out there that truly, truly have in private given Dr. Ernest L. Martin great accolades, but when it came to the public statements in appreciation for Dr. Martin's work, they remained silent. So, anyway, we are very appreciative of Dr. Ernest L. Martin, David Seeloff, a very special person, and also Ramona Martin. God bless her. She was Dr. Martin's wife. She is there. And you can, I suppose, can't you, David, communicate with her?
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
People can email her, too.
AskOffice@askelm.com.
Give it out one more time.
It's AskOffice@askelm.com.
AskOffice@askelm.com. If you would like to communicate with Dr. Ernest L. Martin's wife, Ramona. This concludes part three, and we will
Part four.
Ah, yes. No.
No, part.
Part three. We haven't.
Keep quiet.
We haven't done part four yet, David. That's the part about God's wife.
All right.
Okay. It'll be very lengthy. So anyway, God bless you all for listening, and go and study, and go to AskElm.com. You will find wonderful, enlightening information there. Good night, everybody.